Welcome to Hour 2 of the Global Research News Hour, brought to you by Global Research and Republic Broadcasting. And the topic in this hour, the general topic, is political prisoners, a very core topic for me, and specifically one man and a very, very courageous activist woman who has championed him since his trial began back in, I believe, 2003, 2004. Her name is Catherine Hughes. And I describe her as representing the best of citizen activism. She's a Scottish national who's lived in the U.S. for about 20 years. She has a website. The site is Darfir Trial. Let me spell that. DHAFIR trial.net. The man in question is Dr. Rafael Darfir, who, like other men of Muslim faith, have been unfairly targeted, demonized, accused, indicted, tried. Juries have been terrified to convict them. They usually do. In the case of Dr. Darfir, Catherine wrote about him. She monitored his trial, virtually the entire trial that ran 17 weeks up in Syracuse, New York. And she wrote about it. She wrote a wonderful article about it with, I think, maybe as wonderful a title as I ever heard. And the title was Crime of Compassion. That was the crime of this man who gave of himself. He's an Iraqi American. He gave of himself. He established a charity called Help the Needy. He spent $1 million or so of his own money to bring desperately needed medical and other help to Iraqi people who were being criminally brutalized under the sanctions that began under George Bush Sr. and Bill Clinton for 8 years, under George Bush until the 2003 war. And Bill Clinton alone was responsible for probably killing 1.5 million Iraqis, two-thirds of whom were children, mostly under age 5. Talk about a crime. That's a real crime. Rafael Darfir tried to do what he could to help, to soften the blow. How much can one man do? He's now serving 22 years in prison, doing hard time for his crime of compassion. Catherine, are you on with me?
I am, Steve.
Oh, welcome to the program. And I must add, with everything else, my dear friend, who you discovered me back when I first began writing. And I think the first article you ever posted on your website, unrelated to Dr. Darfir, was one I wrote on Venezuela, another important topic for me. But that's the way we met each other, even though we've never met in person. But,
no.
But I consider you a dear friend, and maybe one day we will be able to meet. But we want to talk about Rafael's case and let you give listeners a chance to really understand it from the very beginning. We have a few commercial breaks, and one is coming up momentarily, so we can just continue this before you get into it. We'll wait till after the break, and then you can get into it in detail. But I think it's important for listeners to know what this man was put through. And I read about political prisoners a fair amount, and I'll mention a couple of others in the hour. And I have a tagline on the end of some of my programs. And the tagline is, today we're all Rafael Darfirs, or Sami Alarians, or others who are unfairly targeted. Catherine, let's take a break, and then you jump in and explain his situation going back to the beginning of your involvement.
Thank you.
Welcome back to the News Hour. I'm Steve Lindman. We're in Hour 2. My guest is Catherine Hughes, and we're talking about political prisoners in the country. We do have those. We have quite a few of those, but you never hear about it in the news. And we're talking mainly about one glorious human being, Dr. Rafael Darfir, serving 22 years for his crime of compassion. Catherine, explain his case to listeners from the time of your involvement.
Okay. I really appreciate the opportunity to tell people about Dr. Darfir. I think it's a very important case in a context of, you know, this is period are facing the kind of unfair harassment and prosecution that he's been subject to. And as you say, I mean, he's got a stunning 22 years in jail for helping sick and starving civilians in Iraq during the embargo on that country. And I've been passionate about civil liberties since I was about 14, when I saw a British documentary of the Allies going into Bergen-Belsen and the bulldozers pushing these bodies of... I just couldn't, as a 14-year-old, understand how something like that could happen. And it really spurred, for the last 30 years, I've read as much as I could about that time in Europe. And I've always been very grateful for my civil liberties and never taken them for granted. And after 9/11, when I noticed what seemed to be happening to people of Muslim faith, when it came to my own community, I was drawn to go to the trial, and the ACLU were looking for court watchers in this case. They had a deep concern that it appeared that Dr. Duffier was being selectively prosecuted because he was a Muslim. And although state and federal government officials had portrayed his case in the context of the war on terror, there was never any allegations of terrorism, and he never faced any charges. But they continued to smear him with that label, and they also denied him bail and denied him access to his counsel. And that was a big concern of the ACLU. And so I started to attend the trial in October 2004. And at that time, Dr. Duffier had already been held for 19 months without bail. And after a very lengthy trial, he was eventually sentenced to 22 years. And the government in these cases does everything it can to get a plea bargain because it's much more efficient for them. And actually, I read a book by a judge who stood down. I mean, 93% of cases in this country are settled by plea bargain. And that's basically because the odds are stacked so heavily against a defendant. But Dr. Duffier wasn't going to be bullied into a plea, although many of his co-defendants did in fact take plea bargains, but he decided to go to trial. And because he wouldn't take a plea agreement, the government just piled on the charges. And in the end, when he came to trial, he faced a 60-count indictment. And that was basically, he was charged with breaking the sanctions, that's an IEPA violation, tax evasion, money laundering. These are all charges that, when they're viewed in the context of him breaking the sanctions, are very easy to understand. They then piled on another 25 charges of Medicare fraud. Dr. Duffier's an oncologist and actually treated people for free, paid for medicine out of his own pocket. Really, a man of the utmost integrity and compassion, as far as I could see from the trial. And really, the injustice that I witnessed has propelled my action for almost 4 years now. As you say, I've written several articles about the case. I keep up a website, and it's not just a website about Dr. Duffier's case. As you mentioned, I posted your article on Chavez because I see his case not only in the context of what's happening nationally, but what's happening internationally. I think we have to pay attention to...
Catherine, I think it's important to point out the reason people like Dr. Dafir are targeted. I wanted to ask you a question, too, about the plea bargain, but the reason these people are targeted, the only way the government can get away with the things they're doing is to scare the public and the Congress and the courts into compliance. So you need bad guys out there. So Muslims are the designated bad guys. There's nothing bad about Muslims. I have a very dear Muslim friend in Chicago, and she's very much like you, Catherine. She is just a wonderful person. She's a doctor. About the last label you would ever put on her would be to call her a terrorist. But in the age we live in, I mean, who knows who might be called anything? So you have designated bad guys, and you go after them, and you get them convicted, and you put them in prison, and you convince the public that you're really protecting them. You're protecting them, and you're protecting the national security, and it's all a hoax. It's all a big lie, and you get the Congress and the courts to go along, so you get all of these repressive laws passed, and the courts become very supportive. They're on the side of the government. You've got these conservative justices, many appointed by George Bush, sitting on the courts. And it's very tough to get due process given this kind of a situation. The question I wanted to ask you was, and I don't know if it would have done him any good, do you have any idea what they offered him in the plea bargain?
You know, I really don't, and I don't know that they would have been terribly specific, but I know that there was pressure on him because there was a lot of money from his charity that was being held, and the government, Dr. Dafir had already arranged that money would be used to buy wheelchairs for people in Iraq, and the vendor had agreed to a two-for-one deal, but the government wouldn't allow that to go through unless Dafir took a plea. And, I mean, he... Just from coming to know him from the trial, there was just no way that he was ever going to plead guilty to something that he didn't do. I mean, it seems like quite rightfully he has righteous indignation about what has happened to him. I mean, he was abducted at 6 o'clock in the morning on his way to his medical practice. The other agents smashed down the door of his house and held guns to his wife's head. They took all his computer, his library, things that even now I don't think have been returned. I mean, that was another thing. He didn't have access to all his documents. So to rebut the Medicare charges his defense was very, very difficult because he was held without bail, which is highly unusual in a first crime white collar. And he had access was limited between him and his lawyers, and he also was limited in access to his own records. So also, having sat through virtually the whole trial, and it was very frightening to see him being convicted on what I perceived to be a very weak case. And I was one of about 12 ACLU court watchers, and most of the people there, I mean, everybody there, had the concerns that the ACLU had voiced. Many of the people were from other religions, several pastors and wives and, you know, people who are very active in their faith, and all came together because they were concerned. Here was a man who was acting from the best in his faith. He was sending help to needy people. And, you know, just as the Nuremberg Principle says that we should reach out to people in need, whether, you know, the... I mean, it was against the law, although it was clear at trial that Dr. Bashir couldn't believe that the government really would object to crucial medical aid and food getting through.
Yes,
and I think one of the things that's really, really frightening is about this case, and just one of the things, because there are many, but that people who are responding out of humanitarian instincts can pay such a penalty. And, you know, that's really why I called my, that one of the first articles I wrote.
This is Cascadia Public Radio.
Welcome back to the News Hour. We're on with Catherine Hughes talking about the case of Dr. Rafael Dafir. Catherine, the reason that I didn't realize that Rafael was offered a plea bargain, the reason that I'm curious about it is that I suspect that if he took it, it might not have helped him at all. And the case of Sami Alarian stands out. And
right.
The big
yeah.
difference between him and Rafael is that Alarian was exonerated by a jury, and he's still imprisoned. Well, his lawyers
right.
struck a plea bargain with the government, and then the government just trashed the plea bargain and kept going after him. And now he's been criminally indicted. He's indicted for criminal contempt. He had other charges of civil contempt brought against him. There may be a little softening in the courts about him because the civil contempt charges have been dismissed, and the latest proceeding in court with him, a federal judge has granted him bail. Now, granting it and being out on it may be worlds apart, and the Justice Department is fighting it. So who knows what will happen. But Catherine, this gives me hope that maybe a few federal judges who maybe a few years ago never would have done this are getting a little bit fed up with these witch hunt persecutions and prosecutions. And
well,
we see,
you know, there's a case in Boston recently of CARE International, another U.S. Islamic charity. You know, that was Dr. Dafir's main problem, was that his charity helped the needy, was sending aid, and since 9/11, the government has gone after and closed down so many Muslim charities. But in Boston, even after the jury convicted the people involved in CARE International, the Judge Dennis Saylor actually set some of the verdicts aside because he said there was not enough evidence to convict on these charges. And for me, having been involved in this case for the last 4 years, having seen what's happening across the country to Muslim charities, to have a judge do this is very, very heartening, because being involved in the legal process over these last 4 years, I certainly have lost confidence in the system, and perhaps I just was naive before, but it's very clear to me that it's not about fairness and justice, and it's about the law and how the law can be manipulated, and that is very, very frightening.
Well, we live in a very frightening time, but every ray of hope gives us hope that maybe others will follow, and to me the greatest ray of hope is the conservative Supreme Court three times has overruled the Bush administration. I mean, they basically go along with everything. And I wrote an article about how pro-business the Supreme Court is. I mean, to a level of outrage, they're so pro-business. But three times they overruled the Bush administration in saying Guantanamo detainees have habeas rights, meaning they can challenge their detention, incarceration in civil court, Twice the Congress, the administration got the Congress to pass repressive laws to override the Supreme Court. The third time, the latest one was the 2006 Military Commissions Act, which is known as the Torture Authorization Act, and I've written a good bit about that in the past. It remains to be seen. The latest decision was June 12th, the so-called Boumediene decision, which was discussed on the program I missed when I was a little bit unavailable to be here. But a very, very important decision. And will the Congress override the Supreme Court for the third time? Well, who knows? Who knows? They'd have to come up with a terrible law to do it. And now these terrible military commission crimes are starting. The first one began today at Guantanamo. And in the article that I wrote about torture, Catherine, the one before the latest you got, I forget the name of the U.S. official, but the official does not want these people to be able to go before a civil court. And he basically laid down a mandate that we absolutely have to have convictions. In other words, it doesn't matter if a person on trial is innocent. We absolutely have to convict them and prove that we're holding bad guys down here. So the whole process is rigged. It's rigged to convict, and there's no possibility of judicial fairness. Well, Raphael went through the same thing.
You know, and that's something I think people really need to sit up and take notice about. You know, it's happening in Guantanamo. It's actually happening in this country. Dr. Dafir is being held in a special prison unit in Terre Haute, Indiana, which is for basically just Muslims and Arab prisoners. And, you know, that's a tremendous concern. And one of the things that's happened over and over again for me in these cases is, you know, this is unconstitutional, but apparently it doesn't matter. We have a lot of these, you know, like I was saying earlier, the Nuremberg Principles or international law or the Constitution even.
Oh, absolutely, Catherine. We have to take another break, but another one of my taglines is, the law of the land today is lawlessness. We'll come back right after the break.
Okay.
You're listening to the Republic Broadcasting Network, because you can handle the truth.
Welcome back to the News Hour. I'm on with Catherine Hughes talking about Raphael Dafir, political prisoners overall in the age of the so-called war on terror. Catherine, you brought up the CMU at Terre Haute, Indiana. It most certainly is illegal. And if you'll allow me, I wanted to read something that another man there, who I consider a personal friend now, he also an innocent man, unjustifiably convicted, completely innocent, just like Raphael. We've discussed him on my program. You know who I'm talking about, Yassin Aref.
Yeah.
And he wrote a wonderful book. He came to this country, didn't speak English, is still learning. His English is a bit broken, but we exchanged letters. I understand every word he says to me. And we've also exchanged a couple of emails when they let him send them. But the so-called CMU, Communications Management Unit, it opened in 2006, and it's supposedly for so-called, I think in their words, high security risk Muslim and Middle Eastern prisoners. You know, what's high security about a man who's who at another time might be called a male Mother Teresa? That's what they call a high security risk Muslim. With a lot of emphasis on Muslim. You know, if he were Christian, he wouldn't be sitting in the CMU now. If he were Jewish, he wouldn't be sitting in the CMU now. The CMU violates prison regulations, And they say that there can be no discrimination against inmates based on religion or race or national origin, sex, or anything else. I mean, it's completely illegal. And there was a Supreme Court decision in 2004 that said the same thing. But
right.
the Bush administration, as you said, Catherine, just completely ignores the law and does what it wants to do.
And that's really why it's so important that we keep speaking out, you know, regardless.
Oh, it's crucially important, Catherine. Can I read, Yassine wrote an article. Can I just read a little bit of what he wrote about the life at the CMU? He wrote this in the fall of 2007, and he's got a website. Anybody can find it just by Googling Yassine, Y-A-S-S-I-N-R-F-A-R-E-F. You'll go right to his site, and you'll see just who he is, what kind of person he is, what he's been through. And if you Google his name and my name, you'll see the articles that I wrote about him. But he wrote an article he called Dead Life, Inside Out and Upside Down, Life at the Communication Management Unit. And he said his English was broken, and he had a little bit of help smoothing it out. But he said, the CMU is geared toward revenge, to hurt for the sake of hurting. There's no pretense of rehabilitation, no thought of protecting society from harm. The place is a playground for thugs who like to make people suffer. CMU inmates are locked down in this old leaky building and prohibited from hugging our children and calling them often. This will never bring peace to the country. It will never make the nation safer. But it is really putting the justice system in this country on trial. Those are just some of his comments. And this he, like Raphael, is an absolutely, supremely glorious human being. He was sentenced to 15 years in a trumped-up trial, and in his case, the FBI concocted an absolutely fictitious frame against him, and he had 15 years in prison. His appeal was just turned down. Rafael's appeal is coming up next month in August, and I hope for better results on that.
Well, we always have to hope, you know. I mean, you're talking about Yassine. He was a leader in his community, and he was the imam of the mosque. And, you know, Dr. Dafir was an absolute pillar of his community. And when they take out these pillars of the community, they do it in a way that terrorizes the rest of the community. You know, for example, on the morning of Dr. Dafir's arrest, 150 Muslim families were interrogated between the hours of 6 and 10. And, you know, people who were nationals had the FBI go to them. People who were immigrants had immigration officials. People who were doctors or had businesses had IRS agents. And it has a very, very chilling effect on the community here. I mean, the community here, although very, very supportive of Dr. Dafir, I mean, he is an esteemed member of this community, they are very, very frightened to speak out.
Oh.
And, you know, I wanted to go back to the judge that I just talked about in Boston who set aside the charges, you know, set aside the verdicts of the jury because he felt there was insufficient evidence. And that's certainly how I felt in Dr. Dafir's trial. And actually on my website, I started to go through the indictment to say why I didn't believe the government proved their case. And, you know, when the verdicts were read, 3 women on the jury were crying and 2 women mouthed, "I'm sorry," to Dr. Dafir. And, you know, if you think that you've done the right thing, that's not something that you do. And another thing I wanted to say was I think juries are lulled into a false sense of security that if they don't, if they get the conviction wrong, it can be overturned on appeal. But what people don't understand is an appeal is not a retrial. The only thing that can be addressed at the appeal is whether or not the law was followed to the letter. So appeal lawyers in Raffles' case can only challenge whether the trial was conducted fairly. And as you say, oral arguments in Raffles' case will be heard on August 28th. And, I mean, some of the things that his lawyers are challenging is that there was insufficient evidence to convict him on the mail and the wire fraud. And basically that's because the government are saying that he took $300,000 of help the needy money. And these lawyers are saying, you know, he donated $1.4 million of his own money, and there's no way to assume that what happened was Dr. Zafir sent money to Jordan, which was then used to send aid into Iraq. And the man in Jordan complied with all the Jordanian regulations before any money or aid went into Iraq. On one occasion, money was called back to this country, and, you know, what his lawyers are saying is there's, you don't know if that could be his own money. And the government just overwhelmed the jury with evidence. I mean, I took notes for 5 hours a day for the whole trial, and the judge actually discouraged the jurors from taking notes. I mean, he didn't say they couldn't, but he told them to listen. But, you know, for me, it's been so important to have those notes. I read over them and remember things that happened. And, you know, the trial started at the end of October, and it was the beginning of February before the jury started to deliberate. So there was a lot of things that had happened very early on in the trial. And I really, you know, that must have been difficult to know, you know, so long. I had never really understood the American phrase, don't make a federal case out of it, until I was sitting watching this trial. And it just seemed like if the government had been really interested in sorting this out, I mean, particularly the Medicare part of the case, I thought the government had completely shot themselves in the foot, because that was so unbelievably ridiculous. And
Catherine, the government wants the jury and the judge and the public to react on the emotion that they create, and not pay any attention to the facts that may come down on the side of the defendant. So, and again, you've got a conservative judge that maybe is very willing to go along with this. So forget the facts and just react to the hysteria that the government creates about a guy, and maybe even a little bit of fallout that, you know, the government is here to protect us, so believe what they say. They wouldn't be doing this if they really weren't going after a bad guy. And it's a terrible situation. It's sheer state terror against innocent people. And anybody can be targeted for any reason. And just imagine you, I, or your next door neighbor, or anyone going up against the power of the federal government that, I mean, they can do anything they want. And they have unlimited resources. And, you know, what can an ordinary person do against this?
They really can, Steve. And that's what really, really struck me sitting through this trial. I just thought if they can get him, they can get anybody. And that is a very, very sobering thought. You know, it's a thought that stays with me. And not only that, but, you know, they can destroy people in the newspaper, which is basically what the local newspaper did. You know, because the government didn't bring any terrorism charges and it was a white-collar crime, none of the national papers covered it. And, you know, the person who covered it for the local newspaper really, you know, I had never read the local newspaper until I went to that trial. And to sit through the trial each day and then see what was written in the paper the next day was terrifying, that people got their news that way. And, you know, I've complained to the newspaper about that, but it's really, really frightening. I thought the newspaper's job was to give the public both sides so that the public could make up their mind. The newspaper didn't address the fact that, you know, that Dr. Duffier was responding to the sanctions. You know, the government kept that context out of the courtroom. But that doesn't mean that the newspaper needed to keep that context out of the courtroom. And this was a case that needed that context in order for it to be understood. I mean,
Catherine,
as you said when you introduced, between 1.5 and 2 million people were killed throughout the 90s. This is what Dr. Duffier was responding to. That was his crime of compassion.
Absolutely. And unfortunately, the media becomes a mouthpiece for the government. And we sure talked about it in the last hour, going back to the Balkan Wars. We're just a steady stream of disinformation, outright lies about what was going on that went on year after year. And, of course, the run-up to the Iraq War of 2003, probably the darkest hour of mainstream U.S. journalism. And as far as the sanctions period during the 1990s, the need in Iraq was so overwhelming. I mean, people were dying. Dennis Halliday, the UN humanitarian chief, resigned, and he refused to put up with it. He and Hans von Spanak, another one, he also resigned. But I've quoted Halliday a number of times, who said that he was asked in his job to commit genocide against the Iraqi people. And he said, I quoted him, that the sanctions were killing 5,000 children a month, most of them below age 5, and even when the so-called Oil for Food program was going on. I wrote about this, and I don't remember the exact amount, but the amount per Iraqi person per capita was getting in food and in medications amounted to something like 15 cents a day per person for food. 15 cents a day per person for food, and for medical supplies, it might have been something like 10 cents a day. So in other words, they were getting virtually nothing. Virtually nothing. It makes a sham out of the whole so-called Oil for Food program. And amazingly, Catherine, at the same time, in spite of, I would never defend Saddam Hussein. He was a bloody tyrant. But,
right.
But his people were so dependent on him, and he actually tried to do what he could with at least a good chunk of whatever funds were available to provide whatever he could to his people. He probably didn't do it out of benevolence. He no doubt did to make the people think that the only hope they have is Saddam. He's the only one who's going to do anything for you, so you better support him. And that's exactly the reaction of the Iraqi people while this was going on. They supported him because he was the only one bringing them anything. It wasn't enough. But nobody else was doing anything. So he became, from a bad guy, he became at least a good guy while he was doing what he could. But and then for somebody like Rafael to be targeted for trying to do the little he was able to do for so many millions of people, he ends
you know,
up...
And we're very lucky. You mentioned Dennis Halliday, who resigned after a very distinguished career in the UN because of the sanctions. He's actually on the advisory board of the Dr. Duffier Support Committee, and he came to Syracuse last July and talked on about the sanctions and Dr. Duffier's case, and we're very, very grateful to have his support, you know, because Dr. Duffier was responding to what Dennis Halliday saw as genocide, and he wasn't willing to implement that. And, you know, Dennis in his talk last year was saying what a scam this Oil for Food program was. And just recently, a Texas oil man who made millions out of, you know, shady dealings in the Oil for Food program was given like a 12-month sentence. You know, so here you have people who are making millions out of misery and get a 12-month sentence, and you have a man who has dedicated his life to service, not only of the poor in other countries, but of the poor and needy in his own country, in his own community. I mean, he had his medical practice 40 miles from his home because it was an underserved community. Since he left that community doesn't have an oncologist.
Just tragedy.
The oncologist who took over his practice in Syracuse didn't take the Medicare and Medicaid patients.
One tragedy on another, Catherine. We need to take a final break, and we'll be back to finish up the hour.
Oh, please do.
Welcome back. We'll finish up the hour. Oh, Catherine, what can we say? This is a topic that obsesses me. In a country called America the Beautiful, we see that it never really has been beautiful. But since the 9/11 event, 7 years ago almost, this September, 7 years ago, we really have... it's really been our darkest time. I don't think there's ever been a time in the history of this country that has been a darker period than this. And we really have descended into despotism, where the good, where the bad ones are running the country and profiting hugely from it. And the good people who are giving of themselves to help others are the ones who are unfairly targeted and called demons and terrorists and you name it. It's an upside-down world, and it's a terrible situation to be in. And heaven help what's ahead if we don't figure out a way to stop this.
And I think, you know, one of the ways that we have to stop it is by safeguarding civil liberties. And I just want to mention my website again, which you mentioned at the beginning. It's the Dafir Trial. That's www.dafir, which is D-H-A for Apple, F-I for India, R, trial, T-R-I-A-L, .net.
Catherine, let me repeat that in case people are slow in writing it down. Dafir is...
my accent.
Well, I'm used to it. I introduced you as a Scottish national, so maybe people weren't surprised. I think the first time I heard your voice, I thought, oh my goodness, what a lovely Scottish accent. But Dhafir trial, T-R-I-A-L, .net.
Yep, and it really addresses civil liberties. I am concerned about what has happened to Dr. Dafir, and I'm passionate about trying to achieve justice for him, but I don't just see it as him. I see it in the wider context of what's happened to Sami Alarian, what's happened to Yasin Arif, what's happened to the Holy Land Foundation in Texas, what's happened to CARE International in Boston. You know, there are so many cases across the country, and I would encourage people to really look into these cases, to find out as much information, because it's the Muslims and Arabs today, and who is it going to be tomorrow?
Hey, Catherine, one more innocent man. I'll just mention his name. I made contact with his family. A man in Los Angeles, completely innocent, held in detention to be sentenced in October. His name is Syed Mousavi. You made his case, you made me aware of his case, Catherine. And I hope to write about him ahead. I hope to discuss him on this program. But it's a case of another innocent man who's paying very dearly because of the situation we're in right now.
And what's really frightening in these cases is how due process is being subverted. You know, that people really aren't getting a fair trial. They're being held in detention when they should be on bail. And this should be of extreme concern to people, that due process is not being given to Arabs and Muslims in the post 9/11 period.
Catherine, we're out of time, and I just want to say thank you for coming on. But I also want to just stress that what may happen to Muslims today can happen to anybody tomorrow. They can go after any of us for any reason. But Catherine, again, we've been on before together. My very, very sincere thanks for coming on this important topic. We will do this again, Catherine.
Yeah. Thanks so much.
Thank you, Catherine.
Bye.
We'll be back next week.
Bye.